This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Recovery Radio. I'm Steve Martoreno. We're here on Saturdays talking about the disease of addiction and, most importantly, the road to recovery. Recovery Radio is sponsored each and every week by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. We're going to bring you another story of success, and it's important to remind people that with regard to the disease of addiction, which is much in the news, it's all bad. There are good stories out there. The truth of the matter is that in spite of how difficult this disease can be, millions of people manage to find their way to sobriety and long-term sobriety. So it's important to bring you those stories to remind people of what is possible. To that end, we welcome Eric Snyder with us on the program. Eric is another of Retreat success stories. He's part of their alumni group as well. We'll find out about that group straight ahead. Eric is celebrating 2 years and 2 months of sobriety, and he joins us here on Recovery Radio. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Steve, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I got to get you to speak up just a little bit so we can hear you. You know, Eric, I like to say that I've said it many, many times here that all stories of addiction and recovery are the same, except they're different. So we want to get deeply into yours. And let me say right now, we appreciate, you know, you talking to us about this. So tell me who you are, where you're from, and something about your background.
Well, my name is Eric Snyder. I'm 26 years old. I am originally from Rochester, New York, and then I moved to Portchester, New York. Just a little bit about my background. You know, I grew up without my father, and we moved to Portchester when I was about 8 years old. My mom met an awesome man, my stepfather, who I actually call my father today. And you know, that's pretty much just the short end of my background there.
Yeah. What siblings and all of that? What'd you have?
Yeah, I have one stepbrother. He is going to be turning 14 in December, and that's pretty much it. I don't have any other siblings or anything like that, and I have one cousin who is also from Rochester, New York, who is actually up here in the sober system, getting sober also.
Ah, is that right? Well, so tell me a little bit about you. It sounds, once again, like another one of these all-American family stories, the disease of addiction descends upon it. Tell us about that. How did you first become, not become aware of it? When did you first start experimenting with drugs or alcohol?
I first started, it was with marijuana and alcohol in middle school. I would say it was around sixth grade. I was pretty young. I liked to hang out with some of the older kids. They were doing it, you know, they were drinking 40 ounces of Old English, and you know, they were smoking some pot here or there, and I kind of wanted to fit in. I always felt like something was like missing. I was the class clown. I liked to get attention, no matter whether it was negative or positive. So that's kind of when I first started dabbling with drugs and alcohol.
Yeah, again, I hearken back to my cliche about all these stories are the same but different. And themes do emerge. This gravitating towards an older crowd, you didn't feel comfortable with your age group, or the older guys seemed to be into more interesting things? That's a common thread I hear, gravitating towards older people. What do you suppose that's about?
I think, you know, the kids my age when we're in sixth grade were the outcasts, were the new kids, the ones that get picked on and stuff like that. I felt I had something to prove, and almost like you said, that seems to be a common theme, not just throughout my school days, but throughout the rest of my life. And I wanted to hang out with the older kids. It was hard for especially kids my age to be with them. They were cool. They would talk to all the girls. You know, they seem to kind of do what they want.
So it was a little. So you hang with the older guys because it's a little riskier, and you kind of like that, right?
Exactly.
You want to see if you can hang with that crowd.
Yes, and I could.
Right. How quickly did it become apparent that you were able to hold your own with older guys?
it was to the point, even at an early age, where I would do things that other people either wouldn't do, even the older kids wouldn't do, that would really get them in trouble. Or I would just do obnoxious things. I would stand out almost, even with some people in the older crowd. I would stand out above them, and my name would almost ring a bell. People would know me, even older kids that weren't even in middle school at that point. And some of them would know who I am, and I almost made a name for myself, so to speak.
Right. Your name came up, and it in certain circles, it immediately meant crazy or far out, right? Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Backing up 1 second before we continue with this, the group you're running with, again, another common theme you hear is that this notion that something's missing. And you say you were the class clown and an attention seeker. What hole were you trying to fill? Have you thought about that? What was missing?
That's an excellent question. And when we went over my resentments in my fourth step, when I did the 12 steps to help me get sober, one of the common themes that I saw was that I had a resentment towards my father. And growing up, my mom and my stepdad and this man's trying to control my life. I don't have my father in my life, so I feel like I'm missing a father figure, somebody to care about me, to show me the ropes, how things are, how to shave, how to fight, all that stuff like that. So I think that immediately stemmed, now looking back and being able to look, I think that immediately stemmed from me trying to hang out with these older kids and have them show me the ropes and almost fill that void for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So take us through the progression of this thing. So what begins as a kind of youthful bravado, I'm going to hang with the older guys, I'm going to show them that I fit even though I'm younger than they are. When does that behavior ratchet itself up to dangerous stuff? Take me through that process. It starts at how old you were. How old were you?
It started as soon as sixth grade. So, I was 12, 13
right.
years old.
So now take me through that progression.
I'm going to be honest. In elementary school, I was kind of bad. Teachers could see that I was a good person and I had the potential to be a good student. But I was too wrapped up in trying to be funny, trying to impress people, doing stupid things. Once I got into middle school, I don't know if I was having an identity crisis or whatever it was, but as soon as I hit sixth grade and I realized that it was a completely different world and I started to hit puberty and I started to grow up and try to figure things out, immediately, I think sixth grade was probably one of the worst grades I ever had throughout all school. So immediately for me, it turned into, it wasn't so much the using at that point because it didn't get out of control later on, and we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. But at that point, I started to have the behavioral mannerisms of somebody that was acting out and lashing out. In sixth grade, I would, we put a M80 in the toilet and blew up the toilet, and luckily they couldn't find out who it was. But in sixth grade, I got suspended because I drew a picture of the principal on the toilet, and I used to call her Big Bird, and I drew in like a Big Bird outfit, and my math teacher found it, and I got suspended and had a meeting with the dean of students. A teacher tried to grab me because I was chasing somebody down the hallway that I was going to beat up. And when he grabbed me, I pushed him, and he fell down a flight of steps, and I got suspended again and had to. There was no progression there. It was almost a snap of the fingers. I completely turned into this just almost rebel without a cause.
Yeah, you went from 0 to 60 pretty fast.
Yeah, very fast.
Our guest is Eric Snyder. Eric is Two years sober now, 2 years, 2 months, and he's sharing with us his story of how you managed to do that in spite of the fact he comes from a really authentic place when it comes to the disease of addiction. So, Eric, all right, so you're a wild and rebellious kid, and you're doing outrageous stuff that gets you thrown out of school, bad in grammar school. I'm sure this continues through middle and high school as well. How much of that is fueled by the addiction, or which came first there? I mean, is your behavior independent of your drug abuse now that you think back, or are they the same thing?
I believe we can sit here and debate all day if you have the gene in you and whatever, if you're born with it or if it develops or it's dormant, whatever. But I believe, for me personally, I can't speak for anybody else, but for me personally, that those mannerisms and the addict behaviors were shaped by my attitude from a young age. So I believe, looking back now, being able to reflect on it, that I showed signs of an addict manipulation from a very, very young age with my mom and my stepdad, acting out, lashing out, trying to fit in, trying to be different. And I believe the only difference was that, everybody will see through the story in the next hour, is that down the road somewhere, drugs and alcohol became a better outlet for me than, I should say, more of just acting out.
Right. So that's the question I want to sort of end this segment with, and we'll pick up on it. Against that backdrop, when you started abusing drugs and alcohol, what did you expect them to do for you? Accelerate that behavior, make that behavior go away, what?
I expected it to make that behavior go away and almost me blend in more. In middle school and elementary school, it was really standing out. Once I got to high school, everybody will kind of see, and even the end of eighth grade, I didn't want to stand out so much. I felt like I was so different from everybody at that point that I was starting to stray away from being that guy.
Mm-hmm. So ironically, something that's really going, this disease, which is really going to ruin your life if it continues, initially you looked at as a way to solve the problem. In other words, we hear a lot about self-medication. In a sense, that's what's going on here, right?
Yes.
Things absolutely are bad and you want them to feel better, so maybe drugs and alcohol are the way to do that.
And they were for a while.
Well, yeah, just for a while. Eric Snyder is our guest. Eric is now 2 years sober, 2 years, 2 months, and he's sharing the story of his substance abuse and eventual road to sobriety with us here on Recovery Radio. We have more with Eric. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano with you. Our guest on the phone is Eric Snyder. Eric is joining us today to talk about his road to sobriety. He's now 2 years, 2 months sober. He's telling us the backstory, how he got in the jam and how he's managing this disease, the disease of addiction. So, Eric, you know, you are a wild child. You've laid that out pretty graphically for us. The behavior continued right on in through middle school and high school. Tell me about your drug progression. You begin with, I guess, alcohol and marijuana, and where does that take you?
Well, so we'll say sixth grade. I was smoking and drinking very spotty. It wasn't very often. And in, I would say, the end of eighth grade, I started drinking to black out. So there was no have a few beers, hang out, anything like that. It was me drinking, having 2 to 3 40 ounces of Old English and them having to roll me on my side so I wouldn't throw up and swallow it and die. That's what it was like for me. I could drink more than any of you. Nobody can put me under the table. I don't care how old you are. And obviously I was hanging out with kids that are in high school, middle school anyway, so nobody wanted to drink to that point, but I did. And I would say that's when it started to progress, at least through the drugs and alcohol.
And what drugs were involved?
At that point, it was just, I hate to say just because marijuana nowadays is different than it used to be, mm-hmm. But at that point, it was just marijuana and alcohol. That was like the least of my problems at that point.
Among the things that is mystifying, I think, to people who don't understand how this disease works is the progression through drugs. Have you given any thought to why people step up? In other words, why do you progress through drugs? Do the drugs on the lower end of the scale not work anymore, or is it a bigger thrill, or what's going on there?
I believe for most people, at least that I know, it's usually through somebody, you know, you're drinking with somebody, you're smoking with somebody, the chances eventually of running into somebody that you're doing that with who has pills, tabs of acid, medications, anything. The list goes on. The chances of running into somebody like that are real high. And for me, who's almost looking for a solution to stand out, or then my progression goes and then it's kind of almost to blend in and not be so different. When somebody tells me this will do this or that'll do that, I'm the type of person who's curious, and I want to see what this is all about. I want to try this. I want to give it, you know, a test run and see what it does for me.
And you, and the other thing people don't talk about is that when you're getting high, you like getting high, right?
I love it. I love it. There's no better feeling in the world. It takes me out of myself. I don't have to worry about anything. And everything's fine at that moment, at least.
Did you wind up using heroin?
Yes. Yep. I started... The first pill I ever took, I believe, was a Klonopin, and which turned into a Xanax not too long from there because I heard it was much stronger than Klonopin, and which progressed eventually over time into Percocets. And then when the government cracked down and put limits on doctors and stuff like that, you know, the Percocets ran out, the... Vicodins ran out, all that stuff ran out, and I was left sick and to the point where I said I would never do heroin, but that was my only choice.
You say sick, dope sick, right?
Yeah, absolutely dope sick.
So were you, and then did you use it intravenously right away, or what did you do?
No, I started by sniffing it like most people do, within a week, 5 days, I was intravenously using it.
Yeah. How old were you during all this ratcheting between what ages?
The pills and all that started right around 9th or 10th grade.
Wow.
And progressed until I was 24 years old.
What's going on in the background? Tell me about the consequences of all this. Yeah, you're getting high, but what's going on in your life? Were there legal problems, relationship problems? What's going on?
Well, I had been in the junior fire department since I was 13 or 14, and I stayed in the fire department until I was about 22 years old. So I was a volunteer firefighter for about 8 years, and drugs and alcohol started a pattern in my life, and I would be in and out. So my friends used to call me Houdini. I would go through phases where I was huge on pills, and I was doing a ton of drinking, and all I did was smoke all day, and my life literally revolved around it. My family didn't matter. Friends didn't matter unless they could get me something or they could keep up with me, and that happened for a long time, but what happened is it started to progress. I started to take a lot of Xanax bars. I started to steal from my family. From my brother, his video games and stuff like that, I had no conscience. I would steal change and cash it in, so that I could get what I needed, you know. And then down the road, eventually, I found the Percocets, which did, I had a little bit more control because I wouldn't black out for 3 or 4 days like I would taking so many Xanax and stuff like that. And, you know, I found those pills in it. They were much more expensive. It was a much harder habit to keep up, and I started to have to do illegal things to really keep up with it. It was no longer stealing from my parents and my brother. They knew what was going on. I was kicked out of the house, staying at friends' houses, sleeping in sheds, parks, whatever I could do. It didn't matter as long as I got my fix. And that progressed into me deciding that I had a problem in Portchester, New York, and I should go back to where I was born, to Rochester, New York, to live with a family member, two family members, which I went there to escape one thing, and I ended up finding heroin. That was the first time I found it, and I'll never forget that first time. You know, I would sniff it. It would feel great, but that first time I was intravenously shot up, that was a game changer for the rest of my life right there. I had found that feeling to a T that I had been looking for so long.
Eric Snyder is our guest. He's sharing with us his story of the disease of addiction in his life and the road to recovery. We have more with Eric. Stay with us. You're listening to Recovery Radio. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We're going to return to our guest, Eric Snyder, and his story of substance abuse and then recovery straight ahead. But I want to remind you about the sponsors of this program, Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. Every week I tell you that I'm going to give you the phone number. And listen, they're not selling anything except, of course, maybe the rest of your life and sanity and relief from this disease. But really, they want me to give you the phone number for informational purposes. If there's any questions you have about anything going on in your life that regarding this disease, they'll answer the question. And by the way, they are justifiably proud of the facilities and the treatment they offer. If it's what you need, they will offer it. But if they can direct you to someplace else or something else, they're ready to do that as well. It's a number we give you, and believe me, the folks at Retreat hope you never have to use it, but it could be the difference. It could really mean something in a crunch. 855-859-8808. That's the number for Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. 855-859-8808. Our guest Eric Snyder is with us telling us about his struggles with substance abuse. He is now 2 years, 2 months sober, and he's made the whole trip from youthful craziness with alcohol and marijuana right into, as he just told us there before the break, heroin. So, Eric, the first time you use heroin intravenously, you think, this is it. This is what I've been looking for, correct?
Yeah, the feeling was unmatched to anything else I tried. Up until that point, there was probably one or two substances that I had never tried, and this was unmatched by anything by a long shot, including pills.
Mm-hmm. So how long are you using it intravenously?
Well, the interesting thing is I used it intravenously for probably only 6 months. I say only 6 months to somebody who's using 6 months, especially heroin, is a very, very small time. But I used it for about 6 months. The family member, my cousin I was with, ended up getting arrested for stealing. And at that point, we were really, really bad. And I decided, you know what? Let me move back to where I was. I was doing better there. I wasn't doing very good, but at least I was doing better. Let me move back there and see if I can shake things up. Maybe I can kind of help myself. I can get sober, maybe just smoke and drink and be a normal productive member of society.
If you just change your physical location.
That's it. For the second time, all I did was move away from the problem, so I thought, only to realize that I am the problem.
Yeah, right. The expression is, no matter where you go, there you are.
You always bring you.
Yeah, yeah. So we want to get to that moment, and this is the moment one hopefully anybody with this disease can achieve, and that's that sort of clear moment when it's not so much I'm going to get to treatment, but the moment where you go, well, this isn't working anymore. Tell me about that.
Well, it's actually really interesting. I haven't heard anybody up to this point reach this moment the way that I did, and it's truly a miracle the way this moment came about. I had overdosed for my fourth time and been pronounced dead and didn't think that I was going to come back, even from Narcan or being defibrillated or resuscitated. And even before this moment, I had been in a coma from something that had happened. I was jumped and put into a coma, and I almost had my fingertips burn off. And I say this because none of those things ever even gave me a glimpse that I might have a problem. But for some reason, this time when I was 24 years old, I woke up in the hospital. I remember pulling the catheter out. I remember pulling all the things I had in my arms out with the needles and all that. I'm bleeding. I walk out of the room. I'm still in my gown. They had cut all my clothes off. I had no clothes left. All I had was my phone and my wallet that was empty. And I remember walking out and the doctor saying to me, hey, you can't leave. And I said, hey, there's no laws saying that I can't check myself out. So they had to let me go. I didn't even have them check me out. I had one thing in mind, and that was that I was really sick from the Narcan that saved my life, and that I was going to go outside and call that same person, because the drug that I got was so good that if I do half and I can get him to give me some for free until I get some money, I can do half of it, and I'll get the desired effects I wanted, and I'll save my money. And so I'm standing out there. I'm in the valet parking at the corner getting a signal, trying to call. At this point, it's 3 a.m. My dealer is not up, and I'm calling, and I just, I must have called for 45 minutes, and I just couldn't get an answer. And I remember that moment that hit me at the end of that 45 minutes where I knew he wasn't going to answer, and I was so sick that I started crying and breaking down. And at that moment, I guess I had an aha God moment, and I realized that I had a problem, and I started to think of all the people up until this point, just like everybody else in recovery, that they've lost to drug addiction, just life things, you know, life being the way it is. And I just started to break down, and I just, it was me for the first time since I could ever remember that it was me in my true rawest form being honest with myself.
Yeah, it is another irony and tragedy of this disease that it takes a certain amount of luck in addition to desire and hard work to get sober. You must have thought many times over the years looking back that had your dealer answered the phone that night, you might be dead right now.
Yeah. I believe each person is given a set amount of chances. Some of us don't get a second chance. For me, I don't know how, but I was on my sixth chance. And as soon as all that happened and I started to get a moment of clarity and sober, I came to the reality that now I'm on my last chance.
Right.
If I go back to what I was doing, I don't have another chance. Somebody else deserves the chance that I could be given. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, so that moment occurs 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning when you've staggered out of a hospital against doctor's orders. What happened next? How did you actually get to retreat?
Well, at that point at night, I called somebody, my friend Kyle, and I knew that he stays up late like I do, so he usually stays up till 5, and I called him crying, and I knew nobody would take me into their house because it was apparent to every single person around town, whether I knew them or not, that I was this low-life heroin addict who was terrible for their children and the community and whatever, but his grandfather and grandmother that he lived with were part of the church. His grandfather was a priest. He did the things for the fire department when we'd have services and stuff like that. I knew him well, and they decided that they would come pick me up, feed me, actually let me stay in their house knowing there's a chance that I'd probably rob them. That's the type of people they were. And so I stayed there that night. I called my mother the next morning, and I told her, I can't do this anymore. I need some help. Something needs to change or I'm going to die. And, you know, my mom's been in recovery for over 20 years now. And she said to me, I've been waiting for you to say that for you don't know how long.
What was that? She said she was waiting. How often did she urge you to do this? Or was she aware that you had to get there on your own?
She was completely aware that I had to get there on my own. And I thank God. It's not the same for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some people need to get a little taste of recovery. Some people's story is to come in and out, relapse, get the difference of opinions and stuff. But for me, I truly believe it was not brought up to me. I never knew what AA was. I never knew. Like, I had heard of people going to rehab, but, like, I would always joke around and say, you know, I'm not a quitter. Rehab's for quitters. You know, I would always joke and say stupid stuff like that. And I believe she waited that whole time, and God had her wait that whole time until I was ready, until it was fresh for me.
That was over 2 years ago now, correct?
Yes. Yep. Yeah. Almost 2 years and 2 months.
And when you say you were in a sense lucky, this took for you. There have been no relapses after your initial treatment at retreat, correct?
No relapses, no close calls, and that's all because of a program.
What surprised you when you got to treatment? What were you expecting, and what happened?
Well, I was homeless at that point. I had already detoxed myself, not completely, but I had gone through the worst withdrawals, Suboxone, heroin, and Xanax withdrawals. And in the middle of June, it was horrible. So by the time I got to retreat, unlike 99% of the people that get there, their pictures they take when they get there are horrible. They look like death. They're usually high when they get there. But for me, I got picked up in New York by someone. I was pretty clear-headed, still withdrawals. I had those for over a year after getting sober, but for the first time in my life, I wasn't using a substance at that moment. And I remember getting picked up, and there's this guy, John. He still works at retreat. He's a very religious man. And he picked me up, and, you know, he looked at me, and my mom looked at me, and they told me, "You're going to be all right." And for the first time in my life, I believed that I was going to be okay. And he picked me up, and we drove the 3.5 hours to retreat, and he told me all about the program, and he talked to me about God, and then I saw horse and buggies, and I thought I might be high because I didn't even know horse and buggies still existed. And the whole ride, I knew when I got dropped off at retreat, I knew something was going to be different. Just the driver alone was just like a godsend, and was able to reassure me. Yeah, it was amazing.
We've had a bunch of guys from the transportation department. I mean, you know, it's one thing to go, "I need help," and another thing to actually get yourself physically into a facility. That's a very critical moment in this process. Eric Snyder is our guest. He's telling us about his road to sobriety, his struggles with drugs and alcohol, and now his 2 years and 2 months of sobriety. And we have more. Stay with us. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano with you. Our guest on the phone, Eric Snyder, 2 years, 2 months sober. Just an absolutely harrowing story of abusing drugs and alcohol as a young man and getting to that moment where something else is necessary or he felt he was surely going to die. Treatment at Retreat up in their facility in Lancaster County. And Eric, a lot of the people there impress you. When people in your condition hear from someone else that you're not as bad as you think you are, or in your case, when someone says you're going to be okay and that resonates with you, it obviously goes a long way towards helping you. So, you know, it's not as simple, though, as just getting yourself to a facility, doing 30 days, and then continuing your life. What are the other factors in your life that have contributed to your sobriety?
I think it's the hardest thing, as I've worked in the recovery field now for a while, and anybody else who works in the recovery field or just has some clean time can say, is it's giving up that power, that control of your life. Saying I have a problem, I shouldn't say it was the easiest thing ever, but that was the easiest part of my whole entire sobriety. It's putting in the work that constitutes how good your sobriety is. You can still stay sober and be miserable. You know, you can stay sober and be half and half. You know, one day's great, the other day's terrible. Or you can put in the footwork. I always say, if I put in half the work to get sober that I did to get drugs and alcohol, then I can have a life beyond my wildest dreams.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like any other. I mean, as they say, it's a disease, and like every other disease, it doesn't help you just to say, "I have diabetes." You have to change your behavior.
Exactly.
In order to manage that. What role did the 12 steps or meetings have in your recovery?
They had everything for me. Up until this point, I had over 10 years of making absolutely horrible decisions, doing things all on my own and not listening to a thing anybody ever had to say, unless it benefited me greatly. And then I was all for it, and I was your best friend and whatever. And the meetings, the 12 steps, and the commitments for me all tied into each other. Especially the first 3 months, whenever I had any decision I had to make, I talked to my sponsor about it. I talked to my sponsee family, which is my grand sponsor, who was the sponsor of my sponsor, my sponsee's brothers, who my sponsor at the time was sponsoring. I talked to my mother. I talked to my house manager, the district manager for the company that was sober housing for me that I was in. You know, going through the steps taught me, you know, the first 3 steps that I needed to really not just say I believe in God, which at that point I had a God moment, so of course I did, but I had to do things to keep a closer conscious contact with a higher power of my understanding, whether it's God, the universe, whatever. It didn't matter. They just told me that I just had to believe that I was not the center of the universe, and I had to smash that idea.
Yeah.
The fourth step taught me resentments, that resentments were the number one offender, besides, you know, girls, or if you're a guy and you like guys, whatever your sex preference is, that I needed to put that to the side also, as well as I had to smash those resentments and understand my part in them and let them go.
Let me ask you something. I mean, someone listening to this might go, wow, that's great, but it sounds like a lot of work. Is sobriety difficult for you?
Sobriety is not as difficult as it was, but like I said, there's so long that I was living this way of life. I still find myself a lot of times trying to fight, you know, doing speaking commitments and going to meetings, you know, as you get, the way I like to explain it, especially to new guys or when I speak, is that my disease progresses with my sobriety. So as I get more sober time, my mind becomes more clever and it realizes just saying we should get high isn't going to work anymore. It didn't even work at 3 months because I was working such a strong program. So my mind comes up with ways you should date this girl. You should go to less meetings because you're so busy with work and other things that you're doing. You should do this, you should do that. And those are ways of my mind tricking me. So I would say sobriety gets a little trickier with time, but it also gets a little easier because you know what you have to do. I've trialed and erred many things, and at this point, it's not down to a science, but I think it's almost as close as one can get.
Mm-hmm. Are you confident in your sobriety, Eric?
I'm absolutely confident in my sobriety. With 6 months, a friend that passed away, I went back home, and they were having a memorial party in his memory at a bar, and I went to the bar, and all the firefighters, he was a firefighter, and all the firefighters were drinking and hanging out, and at that point, I had been through my steps. I was a house manager. I loved the life that I was living, and I'm not just saying this to save face or anything. I didn't think once about drinking.
Well, terrific stuff. I mean, it's encouraging when people hear stories like yours, and we appreciate you sharing it with us. Continued success. And maybe we'll have you back on the show sometime.
Hopefully, third time's a charm.
Yeah,
thank you for having me.
All right, Eric, take care. Everybody enjoy the rest of your weekend, and please look for Recovery Radio on Saturdays. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.